You're about to join Niels Kostrup Larsen on a raw and honest journey into the world of systematic investing and learn about the most dependable and consistent yet often overlooked investment strategy. Welcome to the Systematic Investor Series.
Welcome or welcome back to this week's edition of the Systematic Investor Series with Mark Resimczynski and I, Niels Kostrup-Larsen, where each week we take the pulse of the global market through the lens of a rules-based investor. Mark, great to have you back this week. I know it's a very early start for you today and it's even Easter Friday, so I really, really appreciate you taking time out to do this. How are you doing?
Not too bad. This is it. It's been a good first quarter for a lot of managers, so that's been exciting, and this will be good to take a little bit of time off for the weekend and then sort of regroup for the second quarter.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and we do have a long list of topics, actually, all provided by you, I have to say, so again, I really do appreciate that, but of course, first, I'm always curious to know what's kind of been on your radar besides the topics we're going to talk about since we last spoke a few weeks ago.
You know, obviously we could talk about a lot of events going on in the marketplace, but the thing that really sort of captured me and caused me a little bit of pause was the fact that Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winner, died this week. And so for those who don't remember, Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics for all of his work on behavioral psychology. So he really isn't an economist, but he won it in economics for all of what he did that was associated with behavioral economics. Now, it's interesting you say, like, well, we're having a podcast. We talk about managed futures. We talk about systematic investing. We talk about quant investing. So why am I bringing up Daniel Kahneman? And when you think about it, is that because he sort of highlighted all of the issues with our behavioral biases, the mistakes we made, then it sort of sets the foundation for why you want to be a disciplined investor. So by using rules, we can offset the behavioral biases that we have. So I will sort of say that if you look at the body of research that he's done over his career, it's extremely innovative, extremely creative, and it really sort of changed so many people's thinking. And in some sense, there was this whole school of thought that, well, let's just worry. We want to be mathematical economists. We want to sort of focus in on the math. And so he brought it back to sort of say, let's talk about the people, that economics is still a social science. Finance and investing is still a social activity. And the behavior of how people act still matters in what drives prices and what drives investments. So I think that if you haven't taken a look at the work of Daniel Kahneman, take a look at it if you have a little extra time. There's a lot of good reviews. He's written some great books, but I think he'll be very much missed.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And I'm really glad you brought it up. I didn't expect that, actually, but I did notice it, I think, yesterday. He's definitely put down a tremendous amount of foundational work that our industry in particular have been able to use and kind of build the narrative for why it makes sense to look at what we do. So with that, a super important point. There's one thing that I noticed as well, nothing to do and nothing as important as what you just mentioned, but it was a report that came out from With Intelligence. And the headline I caught, and I know you also read it and you have some other observations perhaps, but there's two things that I, from memory, I don't have the report in front of me, but from memory, there are two things that stood out. One is, I think they kind of got just highlight and confirm that CTAs, managed futures, actually had their fifth consecutive positive year in last year, even though it wasn't a big positive year. And the other thing is that CTAs and managed futures had the lightest outflow among all primary hedge fund strategies in 2023, despite actually it not being a great year for the strategy. So those are kind of interesting observations on an individual basis. One is that I think it's often overlooked how well the strategy have done. People still talk about the lost decade instead of looking at, you know, the great 5 years we've just had. And also the fact that, and this was brought up in a recording I did with Alan this week that we are bringing out with certainly one of the industry leaders from the CTA space in a couple of weeks. And it's this thing about whether things are really changing a little bit and whether the strategy, managed future CTAs, whether we're actually moving back towards how it was seen back in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, where we weren't trying to confine it to make money just when there is a crisis, because institutions really wanted it to be a crisis alpha strategy and so on and so forth. Back then, it was a much more kind of freely accepted, okay to be volatile type strategy. But of course, with zero interest rates, suddenly people weren't looking for 15% returns. If they could get 4 or 5, that was fine. Things are changing now, and I think you have some thoughts on this as well.
Well, I think that the zero interest rate comment is probably the most important. When you think about all the flows in alternative investments in a lot of other hedge fund strategies, generally, let's take a look, long, short, market neutral. Part of it, the whole strategies with a lot of the hedge funds to say, let's get very low volatility. We won't promise you strong returns, but we'll give you high risk-adjusted returns. And so if you have, if your alternative is cash and that's at zero, well, then if somebody says, oh, I'm going to give you a 4%, 5% at 2-3 vol, it's actually not a bad investment. If you look at where overall interest rates were extremely low, so that you could say, like, well, I'm beating bonds. Makes a lot of sense. So now what happens is that we're looking at, you know, in the U.S., over 5.25 on nominal rates. We got positive real rates. So all of a sudden, there is a heck of a lot of investments that if you said, oh, I'm going to give you 5.5% or 6% net of fees is my hedge fund return, there's a lot of people who say, like, well, that's not really that impressive. I'm not really, I could actually put my money in cash and do better. So in that, you start saying, I said, well, let's look at some other alternative investments that might be able to give me a higher potential upside. And then it's when you think that managed futures and trend following becomes much more attractive. And the other thing that I think that's going on is that everyone's sort of viewed as that let's look at alternative investments and let's think of that in terms of like, okay, that'll give me some downside protection. But if the downside protection is just flat returns relative to cash, it's not as attractive. I want to have something that has positive convexity. And that's the underlying reason for why you get crisis alpha, or the underlying reason for why managed futures and trend following is so attractive, is because you're getting that positive convexity. And convexity is what people want. The question is that can I get it cheap? And the easiest way to get it cheap is sometimes is managed futures. And managed futures has also benefited from the fact that since we know that the margin equity ratio is, you know, maybe around 15-20%, so you're holding a lot of cash. All of a sudden, this is that for your managed futures, if you hold for most of your, you know, margin money and your excess cash in T-bills, you're getting 5.25 right off the top. So you're doing pretty well right from the beginning, where before in the, you know, a decade ago, managed futures had zero as their T-bill rate. So you started out the year flat. Now you're starting out with a positive return because of, you know, cash, which is also another positive. And I think that the third thing that's going on, which is bad for the managers themselves, is a lot of trend following strategies are now put in swap form. And so, which is relatively easy to do. So there's a lot of institutional investors who sort of say that I can put a total return swap, alt risk premium swap, you know, with an underlying trend index and use that as another way that provides positive convexity, which is an explosive market in terms of a lot of growth that we don't sort of see in the numbers from asset managers.
Yeah, no, very interesting. Well, let's stick with trend following for a little bit because, of course, we are recording on the last official trading day. But for most countries, that was actually yesterday. But I do think there's a few Asian markets that are still open today on Friday. I don't think the numbers are going to change a lot today, though. But it was another pretty solid month from what I can tell on the early numbers for CTAs and trend followers in particular. And many of the benchmarks that we follow from Société Générale, like the SocGen Trend Index, looks like it's going to finish March and therefore Q1 of 2024 at a new all-time high. Just like we're going to see many of the established managers making new all-time highs in their individual program. And what's very pleasing, of course, to see is that this is not driven by any kind of crisis, except, of course, if you are a chocolate maker and you didn't hedge your cocoa, because that's had a massive surge again in price in the last 30 days, in the last month. I think it's up like 60% in March, and it's up something like 240% in the last year. It, incidentally, it's actually Q1 is also the best start to a year for the S&P 500 since 2019. So, and bonds, as we will learn in a few seconds, have been flat, so to speak. So not a bad time all around for investors and a great time for investors in trend following. If we break it down a little bit further, I do think the best opportunities were found in equity markets and in energy markets for trend followers. Of course, still with a few standout markets like cocoa and also perhaps Mexican peso continuing to offer some opportunities. And now, it wasn't as explosive and exceptional in terms of the performance as we saw in February. And I think a little bit of give back probably came from the grain sector during the March, where prices recovered a little bit from the longer-term bear market. Fixed income, pretty flat, uninspiring, frankly. Metals, probably a bit of a mixed bag for CTAs. My own trend barometer finished yesterday at 41. That's pretty neutral, but again, it's not. It's using shorter-term look-back periods, so it's not really to be compared specifically with trend following. Breaking down the numbers, again, these are as of Wednesday evening. Thursday, yesterday was a positive day in my expectation. But as of Wednesday, beta 50 up 2.92% for the month, up 8.38% for the year. SocGen CTA Index up 3.2%, up 9.35% for the year. SocGen Trend Index up 3.89% for the month, up 11.91% for the year. And the Short-Term Traders Index up 0.63% and up 1.2% for the year. Looking at traditional markets, MSCI World up 2.98 for the month, up 8.44 for the year. And the World Government Bond Index up 66 basis points in March, but still down 63 basis points so far this year. And the S&P 500 up 3.22% for the month of March and up 10.56% so far in 2024. All right. I mean, if you have any thoughts, comments on trend following performance, Mark, feel free to jump in before we dive into your topics.
No, I think that we could dive right in because I will sort of say that there is a big difference, and I'll start with this, will frame our initial discussion, is that I use often as a nice benchmark is the Credit Suisse Managed Futures Index.
Can you explain that? I don't know it actually. Do you know anything about what it's comprised of?
Yep. No, I've worked with the people out there. So it's a limited number of markets. They only trade, 17 to 20 markets. So it's concentrated markets. They want to start to stay the most liquid. Then they look at trends at different time frames so that they could scale in and out over a large set of time frames. And so it's focused on most liquid markets across a broad universe of assets, which includes the grains, the energies, bonds, et cetera. It looks at multiple time frames, so it has both short-term, medium, and long-term, so they sort of scale in and out. So it's a pure trend following index. It's not a index of managers.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have the pollution between trend and managed futures. And they're actually using it as a mechanism for you could either buy it in swap form or you can buy it as a mutual fund product. So it is out there and it's available as a trend only. So it is a nice index. Not as popular as, we'll sort of say, the SocGen index, the CTA index we use. But it's out there and it's tradable. You can be able to get it every day. So even though Credit Suisse, we don't know where Credit Suisse is these days.
It should be renamed, shouldn't it? UBS, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, futures. So yeah. It's going to be renamed. But I think it's a nice, easy benchmark to follow. But the key is that it only has a limited number of markets, okay? And so when we look at the performance of a lot of CTAs relative to this benchmark, and I will sort of say that, for example, Morningstar uses the Credit Suisse Managed Futures as their benchmark index for all of the managed futures products that they look at. It doesn't include COCO. It doesn't include a lot of the alternative markets, the smaller markets. So that gets to the heart of the issue, which we're probably going to talk about now, is the COCO market. And should you trade more markets or less markets? How should you size those positions? Which has been probably our ongoing discussion for now years.
It has. It's such a fun topic to and important topic to discuss. And I still come across it in my client and prospect conversations because clearly they are influenced by whatever manager they meet. If they meet someone who trades 400 markets, they're going to be influenced by that. If they meet me or someone else who trades fewer markets, they're going to be influenced by that. So tell me where we are going to go with our COCO market first topic conversation here.
Well, the reason why I want to talk about COCO is because it's sort of like a combination of everything people talk about for managed futures as both, you know, how you develop signals, how you add markets, how you take profits. All of this is tied up in the COCO market. And so everyone is going to look to this as either the poster child for why you should trade more markets, the poster child for why you should, you know, hold trends longer than as long as possible. So let's just go through this a little bit because I think that listeners will find it interesting. So first, let's talk a little bit about the COCO market in general, because you see a price that goes, up to what, 250% in the last year, 65% in a month. Then the first word that everyone that comes to people's mind, oh, it's a bubble. This must be irrational. So let's talk a little bit about the COCO market itself, and then we can sort of say, is this rational or irrational? Because that's fundamental to how trend followers think and why they make money. Is sometimes just because you see a market have a 200% increase, well, that could be irrational, but there also could be reasons for why that might occur in a COCO market where it won't happen in an individual stock. So first you have to think about, is it COCO is something that's consumed, okay? It's not a financial asset. It's a commodity, which, and what we've seen is that there's been supply and demand imbalances for the last few years where there's been excess demand relative to supply. So it's not a thing that just came up this year. It's been around for a while. Now, what we find out is that a lot of the COCO is produced in a limited set of countries, Ghana, Ivory Coast. Those have COCO boards by the government. So they buy from the farmers. And then what they do is they sort of aggregate all of the COCO they have and then sell it out to the processors later on to turn into COCO butter and powder. Surprisingly, the farmers, even though they sell to a COCO board from their government, the farmers get very little. So their price that they're having is probably, you know, between 10 and 20% of the price that you see, you know, in the marketplace. So if the farmers are getting very little, they have no real incentive to invest in new COCO plants. And it usually takes about 5 years from the time you plant a plant and you actually get cocoa pods. So it's different than what you think for grains or other markets, because you can't just sort of say like if you have a factory, say, well, let's put on a third shift on the factory. Let's build another factory, or let's run the factory all night long. Whatever you planted today, you're not going to see any pods for 5 years. So this problem is not going to go away immediately. So we've had also bad weather. We've had some disease. And then you find out that there are no close substitutes. So, if you like chocolate, you can't get it from somewhere else. So what you have is inelastic demand and supply. So what happens is that small shocks could cause large price moves. Also, as we'll say, cocoa makes up only a small portion of the price of a chocolate bar. So even, the price could double, but that doesn't mean that the price of the chocolate bar that you have at the store is going to increase significantly, because it's probably the wrapping and the marketing is probably a higher portion of that cost of that bar than the cocoa itself.
So, yeah, let me just interject actually here for people who may not know this, but it's actually part of this El Nino effect we've seen, because that caused a lot of rain happening late last year, and that led to some crop damage for sure. And then, as you rightly said, then they had disease, which I think is called the black pod disease for this. So we've had subsequently some extreme heat. So some of the older cocoa trees, have struggled. And as far as I can tell, and you mentioned that as well, because they are not paid very much, the farmers, they have not been able to afford things like fertilizer or anything that could kind of mitigate the reduction they saw in the crop. So I just wanted to throw that a little bit of background into this.
This is unique to commodity markets, and this is driven all the thinking of trend followers for decades. So if you remember, a lot of the early trend followers who were focused almost exclusively on the commodities markets, this is that even though it seems like it's, maybe close to 40 plus years that we've had, bond and stock indices, it's still relatively new for when you think about the trend following over the long run. So that leads to our first sort of like big issue that we sort of see in how people create models and what they think about models. And this is something that John Henry always brought up. The trends last longer than expected. So constantly, so you want to be in a trend, because if you have these commodities that have high supply and demand inelasticities, then you're going to get trends that could last much longer than expected, because you can't find substitutes. So the number one issue is trends will last longer than expected. So always stay in a trend. So that's what we sort of see happening for a lot of the market participants. People who are doing well are the ones who have stuck in this trend. And so I did just random back of the envelope calculations for cocoa for, let's say, a 20-day moving average and a 100-day moving average. So 20-day moving average, you probably were, you could have said, last time you had a signal that the price went through to 20-day, was early January. So you'd be in the same trade for this entire period that we've gone up. If you look at a 100-day moving average, you've probably been in that trade for, close to a year, so you're going back into sometime in 2023. So all the trend followers who are longer-term trend followers have been in this trade for a very long time. They've been able to accrue a lot of profits, and that's been fairly significant.
Yeah, I mean, I can confirm that. I mean, we don't use moving averages on our side, but we got long. I don't think I'm sharing any big secrets here, but we got long in January of 2023, thereabouts. And therefore, it's also completely false, of course, when some of the media now comes out and say how trend following hedge funds have pushed up the price of cocoa and we're getting in towards the end of 2023. It's completely wrong and misplaced.
Right.
Yeah,
right. Like this has been almost a perfect trade for a lot of trend followers, because it's, yes, it has had an explosive increase more recently, but this has been going on for a long time. So people have been in this trade for a fairly long time. Now, is this a bubble? Now, there have been some work out of the, out in Zurich, they have some of their centers where they look at a bubble is measured by what we call exponential extremes. And they look at something called the log periodic power law. So the long and short of it is that if a market goes exponential but it's at a certain speed, then they say that there exists a bubble. So now right away when you start to say bubble, well, what's the likelihood of a reversal? Now, for those who follow this log periodic power law, they would sort of say that as the market becomes more exponential, then it's more highly or more likely that there'll be a reversal, that there's going to be a market reversal. Well, we haven't seen that yet in the cocoa markets, surprisingly. We've seen a lot of volatility, but again, this would suggest staying as long as possible in the trends. Now, we've had some other work on bubbles recently, and this is from a number of professors at the Harvard Business School, and what they wrote a paper called Bubbles for Fama. So Eugene Fama said, there's no such thing as bubbles. Everything is rational because markets are efficient, so you can't have irrational prices. So what they did is that they looked for large increases in the stock market or stock indices. And then they said, well, what's the probability if you have, let's say, 100% increase in a certain time frame that there's going to be a reversal? And what they found is that surprisingly, there's a higher probability of a reversal, but it doesn't always, the fact that you have a high price increase doesn't predict that there's going to be a reversal. So again, from a trend follower's perspective, they would sort of say, hold on to trend as long as possible. I can't tell you when the reversal will occur. I know that probability is higher. What if my model is still telling me to stay long? I stay long. Okay. So again, this is sort of suggests that there could be such a thing as a bubble, but you stick with the trades. So given the fact that you have this inelastic demand and supply, and given the fact that you could have these market extremes, what you find is that commodity markets especially have fat tails. Fat tails in terms of, let's think about our normal distribution, is there's a greater likelihood you're going to have a big move in at the extremes. So, and when you think about it, that's what trend followers are trying to partake in. They're trying to take advantage of those fat tails. So given these large moves, this gets to our next big view. This is it. Trade more markets because you don't know which one of these markets is going to have this big shock that will lead to a market extreme. Let's go back to our Credit Suisse Managed Futures Index. They said, look, it's important to build an index. We want to have something that trades only the most liquid markets. It doesn't have cocoa in their index. Given it doesn't have cocoa in the index, all the participants who have more of these alternative markets are beating that index handily. So there's a huge gap between the two. And that's because they're trading more markets, which is, sort of the conversation we've been having for a long, long time. Trade more markets, because that's what where you're going to get advantage.
Well, this is a little bit of a trigger point. I know you didn't know that, but it's a little bit of a trigger point for me when you say that, because I've got some interesting observations, actually, because I think what cocoa also does, you're absolutely right, it's a great example for us to focus on, because it's relevant for a lot of the discussions we've had about dynamic position sizing versus static position sizing, trading fewer markets and trading hundreds of markets. Okay, so my observation at the moment is that those who trade hundreds of markets, they must have had cocoa, but they're not outperforming those who trade fewer markets. When I say fewer markets, I don't mean 10 markets. I don't mean 20 markets. I mean 40 markets upwards, where probably in, if you do that, you probably would have cocoa in there, right? So if you, it's clearly, if you only trade 5 or 10 markets, there's going to be lots of opportunities you're going to miss, right? Okay, so let's just call it a classical portfolio of CTA type markets that would have included cocoa for sure. But that means you may only trade 40, 50, like done 65 markets, and not 300-400 markets. Okay, so the first thing I notice is that it's the ones who trade the fewer markets that are outperforming the ones who trade a lot of the markets, or hundreds of markets. I think that's an interesting observation, because the argument has been a little bit the other way around. Why could that be? Well, my own guess is that if you trade 300-400 markets, your exposure to any one of those markets, even if you have a 200% move like in cocoa, it's not going to make a big difference, frankly. So that's my, I mean, I could be wrong and people can correct me, of course, but that's just my observation. It's always been my view that there is a limit to how many markets you really want to trade. And I don't buy into this narrative that trading more markets is better. It's different. It's not better. The second thing that I wanted to bring up is this static versus dynamic position sizing. Because although there is a particular manager out there who did exceptionally well in February from cocoa, for sure, my understanding is that that manager actually uses dynamic position sizing. Although I will say, if you can make that amount of money in cocoa, that cannot be very dynamic, frankly. But again, I don't want to sort of get into the details about a single manager, but that's one thing. If I look at it from our perspective, where I sit, we do use dynamic position sizing. And this is something that also came up in the conversation that Alan and I had in the CTA series that we're going to publish. Actually, a lot of the bigger managers who use dynamic position sizing will have been selling cocoa all this year, including where I sit. And so our positions in cocoa, us notional positions, are so much smaller today than they were at the beginning of the year. Yet still, a lot of these firms are outperforming. So, you know, compared to static managers, I haven't seen, obviously, from that definition, a lot of people say there aren't that many static position sizing managers left, but there are a few we can follow. And I don't see any outperformance from them at the moment either. So again, these are just observations that I'm making, trying to use a live example to frame the conversations we've had for years, where sometimes we kind of need specific real-time examples to discuss. I'm not saying this is conclusive. I'm just saying it certainly supports my own understanding of these of this discussion, and I firmly believe that dynamic position sizing can capture as many outliers as static position sizing. And I firmly believe that you don't have to trade more than, say, 50, 60, 70 markets to compete well with those who trade 300-400 markets. Those are my conclusions, and I think I'm being confirmed in what's going on right now. I know it's a bit controversial, Mark, to bring this up with some of our friends, but on the other hand, we need to do this as and when we see some real examples we can talk about.
Right. You stole my thunder.
Oh, shoot. Sorry.
So, well, this is the exact point that we have, is that let's take a look at some of the issues. Is that if you dollar weight your positions, the dollar value of your positions, if more than doubled. So if, let's say, you had a 5% position in cocoa, then you now have a 10% position. So if you sort of say that, well, I want to keep my position size relatively static, you would have had to have been selling into this. Okay. If your volatility weight, okay, and you could sort of say that you could do a slow adjustment of volatility weight. Volatility has exploded by, a factor over 2.5. So again, you would have cut back your positions on this one. So the only way that, you get the full extent of this is that if you sort of say, I minimize my dollar weighting adjustments or my volatility weighting adjustments. But then let's look at what the size issue is. if let's say that you have 100 markets and each one of your positions is a 1% market, market goes up 100%, that adds 1% excess return. Let's say if everything else was flat. So we're doing back of the envelope. So, but it's just good for the discussion purposes. So if you trade more markets and you can point to one of these markets like cocoa and say like, well, look, it's up 100%. That's why trends last longer than expected. You could have these fat tail events. You could have these big moves. In reality, is that if you over-diversify, then you could have a situation that the impact on performance is going to be minimized. So there's more to picking the sizes of markets than just saying is that I'm going to just stay with the most liquid or I'm going to try to maximize diversification. That this is a really big decision choice that managers make, and it has an impact on performance. And you can't extrapolate from a single market to say this is how you should behave or this tells me that this is the test case for why I should do this. In some sense, going back to Daniel Kahneman, there's always a bias that was called the law of small numbers. Is that I come up with one example and then I use that to extrapolate on how I should then apply this to in all cases. So I'm not sort of saying that those people that trade a lot of markets are wrong because they say that that works for them in terms of how they want to diversify, look at the opportunities. But you can't extrapolate from the cocoa market and say, this is the reason for why I should do something a certain way, because it just is one representative market and in an extreme relative to all others.
And I just want to add one thing. And again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing one or the other. I've always just taken the opposite side because I felt that there was a narrative saying that it is wrong not to do so and so. And I think that is what I'm opposed to. I think both ways or all ways to do these things, if it works for the manager, it works. That's fine. But I just want to mention one thing. If your position sizing only happens at the point of entry, which is the kind of definition of the old style type trend following, or original style trend following, you of course would have a great ride, and this may explain some of the large performance numbers I mentioned in from February, and that's great, of course, that's wonderful. However, if you have not changed your notional exposure and you see this price move and the increase in volatility, what it will do, it will have made you a lot of money. So that's good. But what it also will do, if you have kept the same number of contracts, is it will now dominate the daily swings or the monthly swings of your portfolio because it's going to be such a big, quote-unquote, risk allocated to that one position. So that's just what it comes with. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that's the price you pay for having had such a run in a market like that.
Yeah, there's a, we'll say, risk and reward or two-sided coin. This is it. You're going to love it on the way up and it's going to have an impact on the way down. And another way to look at this is that, again, the cocoa market embodies everything we talk about trend following, everything we talk about risk management. Now you have a large gap between, you know, the price and where, let's, and I'm using the simplest case, the moving average. So you have a large gap between that two. So if you say, I don't use stops, well, then you're going to have to say, we're going to have a large give back. Or you better hope
even
to
if
God.
You use stops, I think most people who do classic trend following, they certainly use stops. That's for sure. So I wouldn't rule that out. But you're right. It depends on how dynamic is your stop algorithm. And actually, some stop algorithms, of course, do use volatility to be calculated. So it's not like volatility is not part of it. It's just used in a different way than maybe we would use it, so to speak. Let's leave cocoa for now. And by the way, if people think cocoa is volatile, I couldn't help notice that yesterday, in one day, Spanish electricity went up by 513% in one day. So although it's still down 94% for the last 12 months, it's just to show you that these markets are wonderful in giving us and in humbling us, I'm sure, in terms of what they can do. We have so many topics on your list, Mark. So I think I'm going to let you pick from them because we're probably not going to go through all of them in the next 20 minutes or so. I'm going to let you drive today completely.
So the one that I wanted to bring up and one that I've been looking at is came out last year, but there's been more talk about the financial conditions index from the Fed. So, you know, for those who follow, you know, the macro side pretty closely, there's financial conditions index from Bloomberg, from Goldman Sachs. We have stress indices from the Fed. Now, they came up with a financial conditions index. And part of those is to sort of tell us by, let's look at a number of different market characteristics to try to say, is the monetary conditions, in this case, financial conditions or credit conditions, are they loose or tight? Okay. And what we'll sort of say that if, let's say that credit conditions or financial conditions are tight, that would suggest that the Fed should, you know, loosen. And if they're loose, then they could sort of say that they should tighten. Why is this important for trend followers and for those who, you know, are more macro focused? Well, the transition between loose and tight could tell us something about what's going on in terms of financial markets. You know, what will happen to the bond market or stock market is that we'd expect that if we have loose financial conditions, that the stock market should go higher. If it's tighter conditions, it should go lower. So interestingness is that right now is that the, we had tight conditions in 2022 or 2023, it's now moving to fairly loose conditions. So it actually suggests that there's no reason for the Fed to actually lower rates when you think about financial stability, because the conditions index is telling us conditions are actually fairly loose. It's not a very tight market. So we've been having all of the discussion about forward guidance, and we listen to what Chairman Powell has to say. But as a systematic investor, what you want to look at is you want to look at indicators that'll tell us what are actually happening by Fed policy, not words. This would tell us is that there's probably more of a looser conditions. It would suggest that there's no real reason for the Fed to have to lower rates. Interestingness is that this index is made up of seven financial variables. Everything except, well, you know, is a tradable market except for the Zillow housing market. So most of it is looking at the stock market, you know, bond markets, so let's say Fed funds rate, BBB markets. So what you think about it is that a financial conditions index is structured by the Fed is actually a trend index. It's a trend index of financial markets. But I think the good thing or the thing that I look at is to say, are there other exogenous factors or other ways to which we can look at data that can give me an indication of whether what credit conditions would look like? And if the conditions are now loose, then that would suggest that there's a lot of markets, speculative markets could go higher, given the fact that we're not in a tight situation and we're not, it seems like we're in a transition. The transition is going from tight to loose as opposed to loose to tight. And that ties to the other issue, because when we think about 2024 as we go into the next quarter, is that could the market conditions that we see continue? So I think that a lot of people have made money from stock market conditions is that we expect also that, you know, bonds are, albeit we probably don't think that rates are going as low as what we expected 3 months ago, but there's still the case that we're probably going to see the Fed easing, you know, later in the year. So another way in which I look at is that what is sitting on the sidelines? Because that'll tell us what are going to be the new potential buyers of speculative markets or risky assets. And so if you look at money market funds, they're well over $6 trillion in the United States. Same as in Europe, there's a tremendous amount of money that's sitting on the sidelines. Part of it is because rates have been, you know, high, so you can make money on cash. If rates start to come lower or start to go lower, and let's say that these trends continue, more of that money will start to move out into speculative markets, into risky assets. And so that's going to be the fuel that could lead to more trends. Now, we'll sort of say that when we think about as a trend follower, we expect that there's going to be trends take time to evolve. And if, let's say, we start to see money market funds go down, then again, we're going to sort of see more money move into risky assets, which could lead to further trends.
The other thing I think about when I listen to you there and talk about these type of indicators is, of course, that there are a little bit of a movement, I guess, in our industry for managers who have started looking at and incorporating alternative market data instead of just looking at price. And some so far have had great success with it. I don't know exactly how it works, but it's something that we probably will maybe see more of, I would suspect.
There's no question. I was in New York earlier in the week, and the two major themes, and this is not on my list, but the two major things that if you talk to any quants and we'll sort of say outside of this systematic trend following bubble, because you want to sort of say what are all quants doing, is number one is that AI. It says so people are going AI crazy, and we'll call it especially like processing and text data, which is the number one issue that people are looking at. They said, how can I take text and then turn that into signals? And that could be anywhere from financial statements, earnings announcement releases in terms of text of what they say into their earnings calls. We'll probably sort of say that that is the number one issue that people are focused on. It's not as much an issue for trend followers because we're sort of saying that price is still the driver, but we'll sort of say in more traditional quant area that part of AI is where the explosive research agenda is. The second is the alternative data. And again, this is especially true in the equity markets. It is not as true in probably the trend following area and managed futures, because again, this is that there is alternative data to collect, but a lot of it is market specific, a lot of it is as general. Now, the things that I do look at is for example, is that, and I think that there is a focus, is that data that can tell me about something about what is the market regime that we're in. So another thing that I've been working on is to create it, similar to what State Street Bank has built, is that they have a risk on euphoria index. And what they focus in on is the stock index volatility, currency volatility, and credit spreads. And we look at those as a combination to tell us whether we should be in a risk on or risk off environment. And if you notice it, which is very interesting, is that stock index volatility is still extremely low, even though we've had this fairly good move for the first quarter. In 2024, we had a nice 2023, especially in the last quarter. And surprisingly, this volatility is extremely low. So it's mid-teens. So given that tells us is that there's less likely that there is going to be a reversal in stock prices if we don't have volatility going up. Now, a lot of this has to do with a tremendous amount of vol sellers in the marketplace. So a lot of people are doing option overriding strategies, and they're sort of selling options to be able to pick up premium. But we'll sort of say that there hasn't been a lot of volatility in the marketplace, and that's also in the currency markets right now. So, and we see that credit spreads are extremely tight. So it tells us that we're in a euphoric environment right now, which would suggest that the current environment of stocks going higher is going to continue.
You know, one thing just to circle back and something you mentioned earlier a few minutes ago about sort of the AI discussion, and I meet that as well. But I just want to mention that in a few weeks, we're going to publish an episode that we recorded last night, Kevin Coldine and I, with the chief global equity strategist and head of market macro research in Europe, Peter Oppenheimer at Goldman Sachs, because he just wrote a book that has come out. And what was really fascinating, and I don't want to spoil the thunder here, but what's really fascinating is his view on AI and the other big force that we're seeing at the moment, which is decarbonization, because they're not actually that compatible. So anyways, I'm not going to go into it, but I just want to alert people to keep an eye on that episode coming out in the Ideas Lab series in a couple of weeks. Fascinating insight and somewhat relevant to our conversation today here, Mark. All right, well, we've got 10 minutes left, so we still have a few things to pick from, Mark, because your list was so long.
As usual, we scratched the surface. This is that, where did we start with? We started our conversation, we talked about the fact that we've had, you know, a good 5-year run for systematic managers, for CTAs. We've talked about that this is more, that the story has gone beyond sort of crisis alpha. We've talked about this probably positive convexity. And then another way to sort of frame this issue is that what makes us unique? What makes, you know, what when you do trend following unique in a macro space? Because in some sense, if you're talking about positive convexity and you're investing in across asset classes, it's still a macro environment. What you find out is that the trend following does have different behavior relative to macro variables, okay, that is different than other hedge funds. And one in particular is that we'll sort of say that we've seen that a lot of people said, you know, you should blend carry with trends, or you should blend value with trends. There have been books written about how to say you should be a value investor with trend following. And so what a lot of rich researchers have found is that the sensitivity of trend following is very different to macro risks or macro factors relative to value. So, for example, value is very sensitive, has a positive relationship with term premium. Okay. That's just the opposite with trend followers or momentum strategies. So momentum strategies are positively related to industrial production, inflation, unexpected inflation, where you find that the value has just the opposite effect. So on those sort of macro factor loadings. So there is macro rationale is that what, you know, trend following is trying to pick up is very different than what a value strategy is going to be. So I think that this is what I think investors are starting to pick up is that it's not only is the strategy underlying different, but then its sensitivity to different exogenous factors, macro risks, is very different. So I think that makes it a unique, give it unique return characteristics on why you should have it in the portfolio. So there was an interesting set of research where they said, like, well, let's try to come up with some macro mimicking portfolios. So let's take all the different, you know, possible alternative risk premiums, and let's build, you know, sort of mimicking portfolios for growth, mimicking portfolios for inflation, or, you know, defensive portfolios. Now, surprisingly, I'm using interchangeably the word momentum. What they find out is that for growth, for defensive, or for inflation, is that having trend following or a momentum strategy is important. It may differ between the asset classes you use because they break it down by asset class. So that would be momentum for currency or fixed income or commodities. But generally, is that it in all of these different macro mimicking portfolios, it's good to have some type of momentum trend type of component, because that's going to give you sort of like the ability to take advantage of large market moves, which is an important characteristic.
Yeah. So just for people to know, I think what you're referring to is a paper that's called A Century of Macro Factor Investing, Diversified Multi-Asset, Multi-Factor Strategies Through the Cycles.
Yes. That was a mouthful. But
It is a mouthful, actually. I managed to get through that without
Is it? Yeah. So I think that this is really important to say when you take a step back is that, you know, we often think in terms of what's going on at systematic trend following, you know, macro investing, but you have to, but the investor is looking at this in the context of all the other alternative risk premium strategies. And so now what happens is that there's, you know, from a sales cycle or from a sales perspective, there's two parts. This is that does trend following do absolutely on an absolute level positive? We've seen that the last couple of last five years. So, but then you also want to say, what's the relative story? And the relative story is that this has unique characteristics versus other hedge fund styles.
Speaking of hedge fund styles, Mark, I don't know if I interrupted you there.
No.
But there was a pause, so I jumped in.
Yes.
There was one point that you actually mentioned, and I don't know if that might be the last topic or the second last topic we're going to talk about, where you were looking at a paper, global macro versus trend following. Although, from memory, I didn't necessarily completely agree with all the conclusions, but do you want to say a few words about that paper? And I'll link to these papers, but I will not do it on my website. I will do it if you have your, if you listen to this podcast on your mobile phone and you go to one of the apps, like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, in the show notes of the episodes, there should be a link popping up to these papers, by the way. But that's just the easiest way for me to share them.
Right. Well, you're not going to compare managed futures or trend following versus long short equity. You know, the comparison you're going to make in terms of if you're looking to fill your bucket of alternative risk premiums is more global macro. You could sort of say that systematic trend following and managed futures is a subset of global macro. So we could get a huge discussion about whether that's true or not.
I'm sure we can.
But so what this researcher did is said, like, well, let's look at the HFR index. We could look at global macro indices. And we can look at trend following indices. Let's compare the two. And so what it shows us is that that you get different return characteristics and downside protection from each one of these. Now, what they did is to say, like, well, let's see if there, what are the factors that can be able to drive alpha in global macro and managed futures. And so what they did is they looked at a number of we'll call it factors that could drive alpha, no different than, you know, like your beta. And they looked at, you know, momentum characteristics. After you take out all the momentum characteristics, you don't have a lot of alpha for trend following. Not surprising. That's what we actually do. So, but you have a lot of sort of alpha for global macro. So one way to view this is, one, global macro is different than trend following. Okay. After you take out all of these other factors, you have sort of a negative alpha for trend following. You still have positive alpha for global macro. It doesn't seem that surprising because if you sort of look at trend following factors and you take those out or try to explain trend followers by that, lo and behold, you're going to take out a lot of the alpha. What it does say is global macro is different. But we also find this is that when we put it into portfolios, this is that you could sort of say that it, depending on what you want from your alternative investment, you're going to get a different result. So if you want to have a little bit of extra return, you know, you may want to put in global macro in your portfolio. If you're worried about downside risk, you know, over a long period of time, you want to put more trend following in. So there's a place for both of them. Even though this author would probably argue that global macro is better, I would argue is that it depends on what you want to do with it. And again, it probably sort of goes back to the key point, which we often talk about is that if you add a more convexity, which you get from trend following, then you're going to get some more downside protection. If you want more absolute return, which is probably more standalone return, you get less convexity, then you want global macro. And so depending on what you want, it'll make it have an impact on which one you choose of those two.
Yeah. And just jumping in here, I would say I don't even agree with necessarily that global macro gives you better returns in the long run. I actually don't. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think trend followers will give them a run for their money. That's for sure. But I said this might be the last topic, and then I looked at your list of topics, and I thought there's one more that I really think would be interesting because we have a lot of actual investors following the podcast, both institutional investors, individual investors, but also a lot of private family offices. And you actually have a little bit of a point that I also heard in this conversation that I recorded with Alan in terms of sort of shifts or trends, not trends that we follow, but trends happening in our industry at the moment that pertains to family offices, some of the investments they hold, and maybe the shift that they see right now between different kinds of investments. If I don't want to steal your thunder here, but I think you know what I'm talking about. If you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about that before we wrap up.
Well, a lot of the large consulting firms have actually done surveys of family offices to try to, and pension funds to find out what's your asset allocation. And so, and what the argument has been, or what they've shown with some recent data, is that family offices have much larger alternative allocations, they have more percentage of their portfolio in alternatives than traditional pension funds. They're still driven by, stocks and bonds. And so they said, shows in some sense, that they're more progressive. The family office has been more cutting edge. They've been able to diversify better. But what we do find is that a lot of that alternative exposure has been into private equity. And we'll sort of say that the private equity market is at the extreme. We'll sort of, like a Cliff Asness would say, that private equity is a volatility smoothing because they don't get priced as often, that they could have a much smoother return pattern. But in reality is that may be an illusion. So, for example, in 2022, stock market was down. We'll say that private equity, they put their marks at the end of the year as almost flat. So they're up a little bit more in 2023. So what we find out is that a lot of people invested in private equity. Now they're finding out, because it's harder to get out, there's a liquidity issue. So what I would probably sort of say, and it's a theme that we could return to, is that from within the alternative space that we're going to see a lot more rotation. And the rotation that we're going to see is away from private equity, okay, which has done very, very well. But if, let's say, that we have, let's say, a change in the economic environment, and let's say stocks start to reverse, is that the private equities are not going to be able to sell. So you're going to be in illiquid investments, so that you'll say, well, gee, I want to have more liquidity in my portfolio. Okay. And if, let's say, returns in private equity have been compressed or starting to be compressed, so that then the gap between private equity relative to managed futures or other alternatives has been closed, then you could sort of say that the value of liquidity, or the premium you receive for illiquidity, will not be as high, so that you might start to choose liquid alternatives to be able to diversify your portfolio.
Yeah, no, absolutely, perfectly said, because that's exactly one of the topics that Alan and I was discussing with our most recent guest, which also comes out in a short space of time. This was absolutely perfect. Mark, I really do appreciate you and doing all the preparation for this conversation, and doing it on a Easter Friday at a very, very early time where you are. So I hope that people will go and share this episode, and also hit follow or subscribe or whatever it's called nowadays, in appreciation for all the hard work that Mark has put into this episode today. Next week, we are joined by Andrew. And this will be an interesting conversation because he doesn't trade cocoa. So let's see how, what he's been up to and how he's found ways to actually do pretty well, as far as I can tell, so far this year. And if you have some questions for Andrew, please make them very tough and send them to info@toptradersunplugged.com because he's very good at dealing with tough questions. Of course, you should also go to the Top Traders Unplugged website where you can follow the daily trend barometer and the daily market score. Lots of other resources, and I will be publishing some new ones, some new books actually fairly soon. For those who can't get enough of good investment books, there will be a new updated Ultimate Guide 2024 edition where we've added more than 100 new books. So we're at past 400 books in the next edition, and I hope to bring that out very soon as well. So keep an eye out for that. If you already subscribe to it, to the previous edition, I'll make sure you get a copy of the new one. But anyone who subscribed now to the Ultimate Guide from the website will also be updated with a new one when it comes out very shortly. And of course, there is the monthly trend following update from Rich and me. Always exciting and colorful. And the latest one is also to be found under the resource, in the blog post section. From Mark and me, thank you ever so much for listening. We look forward to being back with you next week. Until then, happy Easter and take care of yourself and take care of each other.
Thanks for listening to the Systematic Investor podcast series. If you enjoy this series, go on over to iTunes and leave an honest rating and review. And be sure to listen to all the other episodes from Top Traders Unplugged. If you have questions about systematic investing, send us an email with the word question in the subject line to info@toptradersunplugged.com, and we'll try to get it on the show. And remember, all the discussion that we have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their products before you make investment decisions. Thanks for spending some of your valuable time with us, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Systematic Investor.